Ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, it's really heartening to see such a wide and diverse group of us coming together today to begin this afternoon as we give thanks for 60 years of interreligious dialogue that involved Roman Catholics on the basis of Nostra Aetate. This is something which, for us as Roman Catholics, is a remarkable thing, but we know too that we benefited from the example of interreligious friendships and dialogues that go back in many different ways long before Nostra Aetate. So at the time of the Second Vatican Council, we were grateful that we were able to enter on a theological basis into dialogue with other Christians as well as people of other faiths. Now, I know you're waiting with keen anticipation because our panel is ready here already with us, and I want to offer a particular word of gratitude and welcome to Maggie Doherty. Maggie, I have to say, has been a good friend to the Birmingham Faith Leaders Group for a number of years and has helped us to organise some really important gatherings to reflect together. You will know that Maggie is working at St Mary's University Twickenham, and the particular focus of her work is the art of living and dying well. It's led us with the faith communities of this city to some really fruitful reflections together on the care of those who are dying and what it means in our own faith communities to experience and to support those who are dying and the bereaved, and also to share something of our faith in the way in which we believe life continues. So today, a warm welcome to our panel members, who I know will be introduced individually later. Maggie, thank you for the initiative which has gathered us together on a day when we reflect, when we share our friendship together, and when we, each in our own different traditions, but held within the evening prayer of the Catholic Church, will pray in gratitude, especially for the inspiration of Nostra Aetate, but also for the hard work and contribution of people in all the faith communities. So I'm delighted that you've come from many different places, not only in the East and West Midlands, but across the country today to be together. Thank you for giving us this time and for sharing with one another. And I hope that you'll enjoy the afternoon as much as I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation, Archbishop Bernard. And thank you, everyone, for being here today. On the panel, because I know you're probably all eager to get started, we've got a wonderful, wonderful group. Ruth Jacobs is going to begin, and Ruth is representing the Jewish community. And each person is going to speak for roughly 5 minutes on the topic of dying to live. In terms of the other panelists, we have Shamim Mirali representing the Muslim community. Thanks so much for being here, Shamim. We have Harjot Kaur from the Sikh community. Welcome. We have Shobha Sharma. Welcome, Shobha. We have Chris, representing the Christian community. And we have Simon Roma representing the Buddhist community. So without further ado, I'll hand the microphone over to Ruth.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's really good to see some very familiar faces in the interfaith world here in Birmingham, and good to be part of this gathering. The art of dying and living well, I think, is, well, the only thing that's certain in life is that we're all going to die. So we may as well look forward to it in as much, or anticipate it in as best a way as we can. As far as Judaism is concerned, we don't spend too much time thinking about the afterlife, because we're instructed that we should be making the most of this life in order to ensure that we'll be considered in a worthy place for the next life. So in fact, what we do in this life, we will be judged on what we do in this life. So there'll be no question of saying we're sorry once we get to meet the Almighty. It'll be a bit late by then. We have to show our service to God and our service to people in this life, and the way we interact, the way we behave with other people, and of course our own private thoughts. This is really relevant. So everything that we do in this life is important. So one of the things that is really significant is to make sure that we've not hurt people or not offended people. So apologies have to take place whilst we're still alive. I found that very useful in my own experience of death and bereavement. Not that I'm dead, because I'm very much here, but because through in the death of my parents and my parents-in-law, it was really important to be sure that we were able to have said all the important things before they passed away. In Judaism, the significance of caring for the dying is really important. Looking after the dying so that they're as comfortable as they can be. The question of euthanasia is a big subject in today's world. It's not a very popular subject in terms of Judaism. While we have life in our bodies, then we have to be living. And so it's the medical professionals or the welfare people around us have to do their best to make sure that we're as comfortable as possible. And then on death, obviously there's a very strong focus on the body, what happens to the body, which is that we have to be buried as quickly as possible. So I have been a bereavement counsellor for a long time, and it always saddened me to hear clients talking about the fact that the funeral was going to be or took 3 or 4 weeks to happen. For us Jews, and like Muslims as well, it happens very quickly. The quicker you get back into the earth, and although there are Jewish people who want to be cremated, the majority of Jews are buried. That is the Jewish law, to be buried. And then the important thing after the burial is that is to care for the bereaved. And caring for the bereaved, there are several stages of this caring for the bereaved. A bereaved person sits in their own home for a week. It's called sitting shiva, shiva being the word for seven days in a week. We sit in our own homes, we don't go out, people come to see us, and we sit on a low chair, and we don't wear leather shoes, we don't have our hair cut, we don't look after ourselves in as much that we're not concerned with the physical appearance. We're concerned with emotions. The custom is not to speak to the bereaved people unless they speak to you first, which is quite interesting, because sometimes you can go to a house where somebody's sitting and there's so much chatter you'd think you'd come to a party. If that's how the bereaved family want to take it, that's up to them. But generally speaking, you just wait and give them time. The first 2 or 3 days can be very difficult. After the funeral, we take off our shoes and just wear non-leather shoes, and we remain at home and we don't go out. People bring food, they come to see us. Nobody shaves. Well, the men don't shave, no haircuts, things like that. And it's just basic needs in terms of how you look after yourself physically. After a week, the next 3 weeks, making up the month, and then things gradually begin to lessen. And if you lose parents, you're a mourner for a year. If you lose a partner, a husband or a wife, then after a month, Jewish law recognizes that you could in fact marry again if you wanted to, which I always found rather strange. But I was also amazed how many people I met through my counseling, where people came and said, you wouldn't know, but a week or so ago, I met somebody and I've fallen in love with them again, which is, I've been married 53 years. I don't think I'll be getting married to somebody else if my husband, God forbid, goes first. And my husband definitely is not going to be looking for another wife. I don't think so. He's had enough to contend with me, I think. But the question is, of course, it's accepted that partners can feel very lonely. Men more than women do find it extremely difficult to be on their own. So that recognition is that after a month, one could remarry again. I think as far as, God forbid, that the death of children is a very hard thing to deal with, but that's the same in all our faith communities. And siblings could also be. Siblings, you only have to be in the mourning period for 1 month. So it's very prescribed, like all of my religion, it's very prescribed. And the comfort is gained, I think, from what we do to support each other as a community. And community is essentially within Judaism and looking after each other in this time, as well as happy times, is also very essential.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Peace be upon you, everyone. I'm pleased to be attending this session because this subject is something that I'm very close to. My name is Shamim Mehrali, and I'm from Alabas Center on the Clifton Road, Birmingham. In Alabas Center, we have a committee who works together when there is a death in a community. So we all work together, and two of my committee members have come to attend this session. We give support to the family, as it is a very distressing time for the family. Also, some families do not know what to do, how to manage the situation, so they need somebody to take them through the whole process. We arrange special prayers for them, help them to obtain the death certificate, collecting the body from the hospital or from home. We also help them in obtaining the certificate from the registry office. After doing all this, once all this is done, then we help them in reserving the grave and confirming the burial timings at the cemetery. Once the body is released from the hospital or is brought from home to the mosque, then we allow the close family members to help in washing the body and shrouding so that they feel that they've done something for that beloved one. Also, once the grave is booked and the cemetery timings are confirmed, then a WhatsApp message goes out to the community members so that whoever wants to take part in the funeral can attend. Everyone reacts differently when there is a death in their family. When an elderly person who is in a care home or at home on a palliative care passes away, then the family is calm, and because the death is expected, the family is calm and so are the community members, and it is not too difficult to manage the situation. On the other hand, when a young person dies unexpectedly, then there are overwhelming emotions, including profound sadness and shock, not only for the family, but also for the community. In October 2024, a young 30-year-old died suddenly, leaving behind a young wife and a 2-year-old daughter. During his funeral, his wife was overcome with grief and her condition was worsening. We had to arrange a medical attention for her. So there are different types of funeral, and not only funeral, but there are different type of situations which we have to go through. While this was going on, it was very, very sad to see the 2-year-old daughter playing with her cousins and other children of her age at the mosque. There are cases when there is a miscarriage. Again, there is an intense sadness for the loss. Most of the time, in such cases, the father brings the baby for the final rituals while the mother is recovering in the hospital or at home. For the miscarriage, there is no formal funeral, as many times the family likes or prefers it to be private. Whenever there is a funeral, we arrange the family of the deceased to sit together in the mosque so that they have each other for their support. After the prayers and after the gents have left to go to the cemetery, then we allow the community members to come and pay their respects to the family of the deceased. And there are many other things which are also being done, but these are the main points which I thought of sharing with you.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Shobha Sharma. I'm a member of the Sandwell Faith Sector Network. I represent the Hindu religion. It's nice to be here amongst many distinguished guests and panel members. A bit nerve-wracking because I'm not a priest or anything scholar in faith, but I represent my own Hindu faith at my local authority. So I have been working with Maggie, and it's been a journey exploring topics around death. It's not something that you come across every day. And with the Hindu religion, we've just had a busy months of celebrations, Diwali and so on. And suddenly I'm talking about death. So this is quite strange, but it's something that we all face. And according to Hindu religion, some of it's quite similar to what we've had speakers, the journey following death is quite similar. I think unless you face death in the family, you don't really know what death is all about, and it's very personal. I lost my dad in a road accident, and then I lost my mother to cancer. So there were two very different deaths. And then when my father died, we didn't know what to do. It's not something when you go to somebody who's died, you pay your respects, but you don't know the journey until you've experienced it yourself. So that was very personal. We were kind of, my father was in London and I was in Midlands, and having to travel there, and the machine was switched off and everything. So we never got to say goodbye to him. It was a painful journey. But with my mother, we were expecting because she was ill, and we were able to prepare her death. We were told she was on palliative care, and we were able to prepare for her death. We knew a little bit more, we're a bit wiser, rather than the sudden death. So basically going back to Hinduism, when a person dies, we have a sitting at home, and people come and pay their respects, and you don't cook at home. People will bring food in. In India, they usually cremate within 24 hours, but obviously here, everything is different. We have to go along with the laws and the funeral dates and people being available to come, weekdays working, weekends, and there's lots of other things. In Hinduism, death is not seen as an end, but as a transition. The soul, we call it the Atma, moves from one body to another on its journey towards moksha, the liberation. The emphasis at the end of life is a spiritual peace, prayer and acceptance, and fear of resistance. In Bhagavad Gita, the soul is never born, nor it ever dies. As a person changes worn-out garments for new ones, so the soul leaves the old body and takes on a new one. So we all change clothes and we move on. So death is very similar to like changing clothes. It's a natural step in soul's journey. Care focuses on helping a person die peacefully with mantras, facing east, and with loved ones present. So at the time of death, for example, when my mother died, we were all surrounded. She was lying there. All the family were around. And it's sometimes who stays with you when you're breathing your last breath. So we were all there, apart from my one brother, who had just popped out. He'd been there all along. He just popped out when my mum left us. So at that time, what we did was we had holy water from the Ganges, and we had tulsi leaves, which is like the special basil. It's a holy leaf. And so we put that to my mother's lips, and we read prayers, and it was very, very peaceful, her going. And we just saw, it was a surreal experience because we saw her go sort of yellow. I don't know whether anybody's ever seen death. It was a beautiful death. It wasn't scary. It was beautiful because we were all there. After the person dies, obviously, you have to inform the authorities. They came and collected the body. We had taken all the jewellery and everything off. And they came and collected the body. This was the worst part because they put you in a bag. Suddenly, that's your mother and that's kind of going in a bag. That was a difficult one. But following the death, we have what's called a grod pran. It's read by either a priest or an elder. It's read after the death. It's about comforting the family. It's grod pran. It's about a form of a conversation that took place between Lord Krishna and king of the birds, Garud. And it was talking about life and death. It discusses what happens to the soul after death and the afterlife. So we don't die. Our soul moves on. We leave our body behind, but our soul moves on. So it is quite a kind of comforting thing. But then again, you've got like special cases like suicide and infant deaths, and somebody touched on that as well. Again, the soul is eternal and it cannot be destroyed. Suicide may carry karmic consequences, but modern practice emphasizes compassion and spiritual care. Rituals and prayers help the soul transition peacefully. Infant deaths are viewed as pure souls. returning from one to another birth with ceremonies to bless the child and comfort the family. So that's another beautiful thing. It's a soul that was born, but it's returned. It didn't have enough time on this earth. What happens, but understanding a little bit about Hinduism is, in Hinduism, elders often offer blessings for a long, healthy and meaningful life. So, for example, we might touch the elders' feet to ask for blessings. So we're always given blessings by the elders, by your brothers or sisters, anybody. Yet there is awareness that journey ultimately moves on, like changing clothes. Death discussions are easier when framed in terms of karma, dharma, and moksha. Community leaders, temple discussions, and satsangs provide a safe place for open conversations. Focus on spiritual preparation helps family to find peace. So we often sit down and talk about death. And this is what's been really interesting, us having the advisory panel, talking about death, exploring death, not as a frightening thing, but something that we accept. So what happens after the person dies, obviously the body is taken away, the family sit down, there's mourning period that goes on for 14 days, and we have the readings done, talking about what happens to the soul. We have a lamp lit. It's always an oil lamp. Normal lamp in temples is made with ghee, clarified butter, but this is oil lamp that is lit for all the days we are mourning. And on the day of the actual funeral, when the funeral happens, is we go and wash the body, put new clothes on the body, and it's usually, if it's a female, it's the females, obviously, and the males and so on, the close relatives. We'll go and bathe the body and put new clothes on. And then the body is brought home for everybody to say their final goodbyes. And the priest will do prayers, and we make sure that everything goes within the into next life. So flowers, we have incense sticks, and where people put money in there, and there's a whole lot of rituals that the priests do. And then the body goes off to the funeral directors, and the body is carried by the male relatives of the person, a deceased person. When we go into the funeral parlour, the priest will say the prayers. He will talk about life and death, about the soul moving on, about changing like clothes, and he will offer his condolences to the family. The family will stand up and talk about the person who has deceased, pay their respects in that way, memories. Then the final thing is Hindu deceased are always cremated. So the eldest son, or if it's a wife, the husband will press the button before the cremation takes place. So what happens after the cremation has taken place? Obviously, there's a time when you have to collect the ashes. The ashes are scattered in a flowing river. Before, we used to take it to India, to Haridwar, which is a river Ganges, and scatter the ashes there with all the ceremony and everything. But because a lot of people don't have any family back home, they do here in flowing rivers where they have permission. And it's again like a whole ritual around that. We never take ashes home. That's the one thing. So once we have the ashes, they remain in the funeral parlour. We don't take them home. We don't put them in necklaces or anything like that. The person's gone. So this is where we are. That's a journey. Yeah, that's a journey. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's always an amazing joy and happy occasion to be with this lot talking about death. Amazingly fun, but maybe I have to get out more, I think. My name is Simon. I live at the Tibetan Buddhist temple in Edgbaston. I was brought up a Christian in the northeast of England and began my study and practice of Buddhism about 40 years ago. Buddhist studies can be very extensive, but the very first subject that is studied is death and impermanence. Every day for the last 40 years, I have recited and reflected on the following verse, which I retranslated for your benefit so the vocabulary was all right. So, of course, I don't know it now. So I'll read it out. Both the outer environment and all the beings which live within it are impermanent, especially the lives of we beings, which are as fragile as bubbles in water. The time of death is uncertain, and when I die, this body will become a corpse. Wisdom will help me at that time, so I will joyfully cultivate it now. Contemplating our deaths has various benefits. It allows us to prepare for what is definitely going to happen. Of all the life on earth for countless centuries, not one of us has survived yet. Not only that, if we think about our deaths, we can begin to live our lives in the light of the inevitable. We really don't have long. If we're lucky enough to survive for an average age, we live for about 1,000 months. Hopefully, I've got about 240 months left, but it may end this afternoon. We've got to be ready. The days and months left to us are very precious. If we choose to see the value of these days, we can dedicate our time to reducing the suffering of others and increasing their happiness. We can face death knowing we spent our time productively and left our little corner of the world better than when we found it. Hopefully, our meeting today will serve to ease our dying in whichever ways we individually need. But even if it doesn't, may it serve to remind us of the preciousness of our lives, our opportunity to live well now, and that we can prepare ourselves for death, whatever the circumstances are in which we end up facing it.
Hello, everyone. Before starting, I'm actually just about under 30 years old, so having this opportunity to reflect on this subject as something which feels quite far from me was actually a real privilege. So I thank you for inviting me to reflect on this. It's been a real privilege to do so. So to begin this reflection, it feels important to behold that as spirits in human form, we have the opportunity to perform end-of-life rites and to honour the lives of loved ones in a diversity of ways. No other species can honour their kin. So this affordance we have as humans is a great blessing. And that's kind of something that was made apparent to me while I was reflecting on this. And actually, that's incredible. Our faiths, or dharams as I might refer to it, give us unique rubrics for conducting these end-of-life rites. They have pre-designed long practice procedures that enable a soul to depart with dignity. It's provided our faith communities, past and present, so much solace and anchorage at a time of potentially deep vulnerability and unsettlement. And I feel incredibly grateful that God has designed these wonderful provisions with such consideration and thoughtfulness. So Sikh wisdom would expand this view through our belief in the transmigration of the soul. We're informed that we aren't inhabiting this planet by coincidence in human form. Rather, our soul has travelled across many vessels, potentially up to 8.4 million life species, to arrive at this point. Therefore, every breath counts, and we shouldn't waste the opportunity to connect with the divine. This expanded view presents two interconnected journeys: our human life journey, which we can experience through our senses now, and our soul's journey, which is incomprehensible and intangible. Yet it enables our human life journey, we believe, to be practiced. This is encompassed in the notion of vanjare, that we are traders in divine business, and our task is to generate spiritual capital through the accumulation of simran, which is divine remembrance, seva, which is selfless service, and kirtan, which is the listening and singing of divine hymns. All of these support the building of priceless virtues, such as truth, contentment, compassion, love, and humility. And actually, one reflection to say is, when we perform, you know, the funeral traditions in Sikhi, we can honour the souls of those that we are mourning through Kirtan and through Simran. And God's benevolence is so great that when we're doing that the week before that cremation, all those things go to that soul. It's not for us, it's for that soul. So in that journey, that soul still has the ability to receive blessings, which is absolutely beautiful. As Sikhs, we're encouraged to reflect on our life context. We're asked, kitho upje kere hai ke mai samave? And many other faiths have similar questions at the root of them. What is our origin? What is our purpose? And where are we going? This presents an opportunity for us to stocktake and reflect on our seen and unseen pasts and futures. And the answers to this are really simple. We come from the divine, we need to connect with the divine while we're here, and our goal is to ultimately merge with the divine. With this view, I'm required to, perhaps paradoxically, live a life which is attuned to death, as it is the moment we are all working towards. It is when my soul's onward journey will be determined. But what does attunement to death really mean? Surely it's quite an anxious state to live in. We're informed, jin nirbo, jin har nirbo tiyaji, din ga bo sabgavasi. When we attune ourselves to the divine, who is fearless, only then can our fear of death be dispelled. So it is through divine connection that we can have a fearless relationship with death and feel prepared for that final breath. My parents once described life as a journey of training for that final breath. And I still really haven't comprehended what that means, but hopefully one day I will. What does that mean in practice? On the ground, it means that there are 33,000 Sikhs living in Birmingham who will require support in navigating end of life, whether in formal healthcare settings or not. Many of them may find themselves in public settings, and with 30% of those residents speaking Punjabi as a first language, culturally sensitive support systems will be required. A Sikh chaplain with on-the-ground experience, who kindly spoke to me before preparing this, has voiced the need for the chaplaincy service to be better understood and for efforts in identifying patients' faith identities to continue. She says that the more advocacy is required around the service, the chaplaincy service, and more investment is required to enable chaplains to work more hours to be of service in their hospitals. This is not light work. When reflecting on my grandfather's end-of-life journey, he was living in a care home through COVID and felt so much strength in connecting with the Sikh nursing staff. He had an active lifestyle as a bhati or scriptural reader at the Gurdwara, and was for many of his later years was suffering with a debilitating experience of Alzheimer's. But actually, it was mutually beneficial. He didn't just benefit from these nurses. The patients themselves have so much to offer, and so did he. He was always a joyful, hopeful presence to care for. So creating the conditions for souls to depart with dignity is where the power of our religious traditions is seen and is felt. And for public health services, to honour this wholeheartedly is a great act of service for the many faith communities across the city.
My name is Chris. I'm a Christian, and I've worked as a nurse for the last 40 years. Most recently, I was in the Midland Metropolitan Hospital here in Birmingham on the acute medicine unit. But before that, I've worked in lots of other settings, in intensive care, many other clinical areas, and I've always really loved my job. Within the Christian tradition, death is seen as a journey to another life, a fuller life where we will live in the presence of God. We believe in heaven. Death isn't the end. Eternal life awaits us. Does that make death easy? I don't think so. In many ways, I believe that the journey from this world to the next is the most important and maybe the hardest journey that we will ever undertake. There's a fear of the unknown, possibly a fear of God, who we know as love, but who is also justice and mercy. Is death something we don't want to talk about? Not really. It's something that we can discuss in our faith. Jesus talked about death. But is it a hard topic to discuss? Yes, I believe it is. And I'd quite like to tell you some stories. As a nurse, I was caring for a young lady, let's call her Lucy. She had multiple sclerosis and she was clearly in the last stages of her disease. She had a young daughter, a boyfriend, and parents. We were in intensive care, where she spent most of her time at that point, and the medical staff were talking about prolonging her life by getting her home on a ventilator. I asked them if she wanted that, and they said, well, we presume she will, but they hadn't asked her if that's what she wanted, and I wasn't happy with that. I knew that this lady was a Christian and felt that maybe she should have some control over the end of her life. So I opened up a conversation with her one day while I was doing her hair. She asked me what going home would mean, who would look after her, and what would happen if she didn't want to go home on a ventilator. We talked about how things might be at the end of her life. How would we in hospital help her? How did she want things to be? Later on, Lucy asked me to recount what we had said to her boyfriend, and then again to her parents, and then again to the medical staff. Lucy then wanted me to contact the priest, and he came in and prayed with her. Lucy decided not to go home. She chose to die in hospital and died a few weeks later, and her family were all there. It wasn't an easy conversation to have, but Lucy took control of the last journey that she had to make from this life to the next. I was able to have that conversation with her because I have a faith. I believe that death is a journey with God. Not all nurses have a faith, and I often wonder how they cope. Education can help, but more than that, I believe witness helps. When I worked in the intensive care unit in Glasgow, the Church of Scotland minister would pop in and see the staff with a, "How are you? It's been a bit of a busy time, I think. How are you?" And he built a relationship such that we included him in our life, asked his help and his advice. Not all the chaplains did that, but many of us learned more from him in those chats than in many an education session. Though because we also knew him, we would invite him to our educational events too. How else do we Christians support one another in this journey? I've got a friend. She's been very close to God in her life, and now she's nearing the end of that life. I thought she might die a few weeks ago. I try to be near her. I try to facilitate that she's close to all those who she's loved through visits, through video calls. I and others have tried to listen to her fears, be close with her, pray with her and for her. Last week she said to me, "Chris, I never knew that the journey to heaven needed so much preparation. It's a journey we take alone, but with others to help us." A priest friend of ours went to see her and celebrated Mass with her, prayed with her, to strengthen her and give her the nourishment she needed to help her. As faithful of different faiths, can we help one another? I believe so. Another story. I was caring for a Muslim gentleman in intensive care. He was very sick, but we didn't expect him to die. His family had been in, and now they'd gone home. It was night time. We'd called the imam, but he hadn't been able to come yet. The gentleman became very agitated. We did all we could medically and nursing-wise. Then I sat next to him. He could hear me, and he could communicate by nodding his head. I asked if he was frightened. Yes. Of dying? Yes. I explained that I was a Christian and that we believed in heaven, a life with God. I also said that we believed in suffering, that God gave us his life for us, and that I believed that God loved us most when he suffered for us. That gave suffering an immense value. I said I knew he had a different faith, but maybe in some respects it was the same. He nodded. He relaxed, and I felt we built something very strong and very precious. I hope these stories express my belief. I believe that God loves each of us, that when we die, we'll meet God face to face, be held in that love. Yes, God's also justice. I will become possibly very aware of the times that I have not reflected God's love for me on others, the times I turned away from that love. I suspect that that will be exquisitely painful. God is infinite mercy too. I hope that I will experience God's mercy. Death is special, the journey is special, and I believe that it's a privilege to accompany somebody on that journey.
Chris, thank you for those beautiful stories. And please, could we have a round of applause for all the wonderful panellists? I'm going to speak for a little while on the work of the centre and the research that we've been co-creating together with Sanwell Council as well, and thank you for being here. So to give you an idea of the work of the Centre for the Art of Living and Dying Well at St Mary's University, it's threefold. The first area is obviously research. It was a community participatory research project. It is a community participatory research project, and it's ongoing because the Royal Marsden would like to take it to London and they'd like to test some of the findings. In terms of other areas of our work, we train the non-medical frontline to deal with death, dying and bereavement. What does that mean? Well, that's carers, volunteers, initial teacher trainees and also would-be priests. We have a multidisciplinary team. Paul is here, our funeral director, who's part of the team. And we also have a chaplain and a palliative care physician. So early on in seminarians, would-be priests training, they learn how to be by the bedside of a dying person. And also we would hope some would think about becoming chaplains in hospitals. In terms of another area of our work, we have the Art of Dying Well podcast, which I would encourage you to listen to. It's in the top 10% of global podcasts. And the desire is to open up the taboo around death and dying so that we truly, truly live. And we've had some wonderful guests on the show. So to give you an idea of what we've all been up to over the last few months, as I said, it's a community participatory project and it's looking at faith perspectives on death literacy and end-of-life care. So it's at Birmingham, based in Birmingham. So between February and July 2025, we co-created this pilot study together. Researchers working alongside members of Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, Jewish, Sikh and Christian communities in Birmingham. Together, we wanted to understand two things: what challenges we face when someone is dying in hospital, and how we can help communities talk more openly about death, just as we are today. So, part one, what matters most at the end of life? Together, and I stress together, we identified essential practices that need to happen when someone is dying. Sacred texts and prayers are vital across all faiths. Hindus need the Bhagavad read to the dying person. Muslims recite verses from the Quran. Sikhs want prayers like Sukhmani Sahib. Buddhists practice meditation to prepare for death throughout their lives, those 1,000 months which we hope that we get. Holy water is important at the moment of death for some communities. Muslims need Zamzam water from Mecca, even just a drop on the lips. Hindus need water from the Ganges placed on the body with a tulsi leaf. Body placement matters greatly before and after death. Muslims need the dying person's feet facing Mecca. Hindus believe the body should be placed on the floor because we came from the earth. What happens after death differs between faith traditions. A number of faiths need rapid burial or cremation, sometimes within hours. Jewish participants told us about burial the same afternoon, but Buddhist teaching is completely opposite. Ideally, the body should be left undisturbed as long as possible for the person to experience peace. Problems in hospitals. Together we shared the challenges which communities face in healthcare settings, and there are also wonderful examples of incredible care. But sometimes hospital wards are too noisy for prayers and rituals. One Sikh participant said it's difficult to listen to Gurbani prayers in a busy hospital environment. There's insufficient space for families. When someone is dying, families want to gather, but hospitals don't have enough room around the bed or private spaces where families can pray and begin to grieve together. And caring for the body after death can be complicated. As a group, we spoke about different problems, long delays getting death certificates, sometimes waiting all weekend because the doctor isn't available, bodies not being released quickly enough for burial, concerns about autopsy when your religion discourages it, healthcare workers not knowing that body scanners exist as an alternative, and bodies being handled inappropriately. For Jewish families, it's important that only Jewish people prepare the body. talking about death in communities. Together, we explored how communities discuss death. Some very positive things are happening. Muslim workshops on death are well attended. Hindu families are discussing organ donation. Communities teach members how to wash and prepare bodies, bringing families closer to the process, as we heard from Shamim so beautifully. And death committees pool resources to support grieving families, very often financially. But death is still a taboo in many ways. Even in the Sikh tradition, which teaches the acceptance of death, many families feel awkward talking about it. Jewish participants said people often make jokes to avoid serious conversation. And the hardest topics are barely discussed at all. Suicide, drug deaths, domestic violence deaths, and cancer. These bad deaths create shame and silence. And you told us that communities aren't good at supporting ongoing grief. Sometimes people expect you to snap out of it after a couple of weeks and not recognizing that everyone's healing journey is different. And finally, what we shared might need to happen. Together, we co-created recommendations. Healthcare settings could invite community members to teach staff about religious rituals. They could create better spaces for families and prayer to speed up the death certificate and body release process, and to invite healthcare workers to visit places of worship. That was a key recommendation, wasn't it? To invite healthcare workers to visit places of worship. I must note there were limitations. This pilot study has captured patterns, not every perspective. There is diversity, as we know, within each faith tradition by region, generation, and individual family. It's a starting point for conversation, not the final word. But the core message from our work together is simple. We need dialogue and connection between healthcare and faith communities. Education about different practices and enhanced death literacy so that everyone can have these conversations.
I think we would all agree we've experienced a very rare and very valuable set of insights into how each of the faiths approach dying, death, and the mourning period afterwards. We heard of some of the things that are quite specific to each of the faiths, but I think too we would agree that there was a very interesting number of similarities between the approaches taken. But you might be asking yourself, why today, when we are celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Vatican II Declaration, Nostra Aetate, why are we looking at approaches to dying and death? Just want to read from a little bit. It's the first paragraph near the end of that. Men and women expect from the various religions answers to the hidden enigmas of the human condition, which today, as in times long ago, deeply stir the inner hearts of humanity. What is the human person? What is the meaning and purpose of our life? What is good and what is sin? What is the origin? What is the purpose of human suffering? What is the way to attain true happiness? What are death, judgment, and retribution after death? What finally is that final, unutterable mystery which gathers up our existence, from which we take our rise and towards which we move? All of us in our various faiths are preoccupied with approaches to dying and to death. And so it has been so good and so valuable that we take that close look at the research that has been going on. I too would want to echo the thanks that have been given to our panelists. Thank you for your openness in sharing your faith approach to facing death and the period of mourning afterwards. It was an interesting discussion on the vital importance of hospital chaplains and their close cooperation, their understanding of something of each other's faiths, and their willingness in times of absence of the particular faith chaplain to be able to offer comfort and support to the one dying and to their families and friends. I know from hearing from our hospital chaplains that that's what they are doing. And there is such a close connection between those chaplains that they stand in while they are waiting on the chaplain, perhaps travelling some distance to be able to arrive. I think the other important thing that's been raised really is the importance of ongoing religious literacy in our hospitals amongst the National Health Service. I suppose that's been said by faith communities for many years now, but again, I think it's been highlighted this afternoon.